Welcome to the podcast Romance with me, Pavi Deva. I'm beyond excited to have you all here. Thank you for listening and being here once again. If you're not following me on Instagram, please follow me at romance_ and also check out my website www.pavideva.com. Don't forget to subscribe to my podcast on Apple, Google or Spotify. And leave your reviews and comments on one of these channels or on my website. In 1995, David Goldman, a science journalist, authored a number of books on emotional and social intelligence, and he has put together a widely accepted and most popular framework which consists of five components of emotional intelligence. The most sought after definition of emotional intelligence is the ability to accurately perceive your own and others' emotions, to understand the signals that emotions send about relationships, and to manage your own and others' emotions. The five components of emotional intelligence as per David Goldman are: number one, self-awareness, the ability to recognize and understand personal moods and emotions and drives as well as their effects on others. Number two, self-regulation, the ability to control and redirect disruptive impulses and moods and the propensity to suspend judgment and to think before acting. Self-regulation, which is like an ongoing inner conversation, is the component of emotional intelligence that frees us from being prisoners of our feelings. People engaged in such a conversation feel bad moods and emotional impulses just as everyone else does, but they find ways to control them and even to channel them in useful ways. Number three, internal motivation. Passion to work for internal reasons that go beyond money and status, which are external rewards such as an inner vision of what is important in life, a joy in doing something, a curiosity in learning, a flow that comes being immersed in an activity, a propensity to pursue goals with energy and persistence. Number four, empathy. The ability to understand the emotional makeup of other people, a skill in treating people according to their emotional reactions. Empathy is particularly important today as a component of leadership in the workplace for at least three reasons: the increasing use of teams, the rapid pace of globalization, and the growing need to retain talent. Number five, social skills. Proficiency in managing relationships and building networks, and an ability to find common ground and build rapport. It's not just a matter of friendliness, although people with high levels of social skills are rarely mean-spirited. Social skill, rather, is friendliness with a purpose. When you take your work environment, for instance, it is moving people in the direction you desire, whether that's agreement on a new marketing strategy or enthusiasm about a new product. David Goldman has done plentiful research on this topic, and there is a bestseller HBR article titled What Makes a Leader, which emphasizes on these five skills that enable the best leaders to maximize their own and their followers' performance. I definitely recommend everyone to read this HBR article. Most large companies today have employed trained psychologists to develop what are known as competency models to aid them in identifying, training, and promoting likely stars in the leadership firmament. There are persuasive stories and research about the link between a company's success and the emotional intelligence of its leaders in this book. Every business person knows a story about a highly intelligent, highly skilled executive who was promoted into a leadership position only to fail at the job. and they also know a story about someone with solid but not extraordinary intellectual abilities and technical skills who was promoted into a similar position and then soared. David Goldman writes, "It would be foolish to assert that good old-fashioned IQ and technical ability are not important ingredients in strong leadership. But the recipe would not be complete without emotional intelligence. It was once thought that the components of emotional intelligence were nice to have in business leaders. But now we know that for the sake of performance, these are ingredients that leaders need to have." I believe emotional intelligence can be learned. It's not easy, it needs time and commitment, but the benefits that come from it, both for my personal as well as my career growth, make it worth the effort. I have learned that being competitive at work only causes more stress and leads to failure. Collaborating, helping others at work, and peer-to-peer learning has helped me achieve successful results and build creative solutions at work. Having this headspace will help you grow in your career and get alignment across teams and leadership quickly. Emotional intelligence can be developed through practice and feedback from others. What I have found really helpful is taking these EQ tests online, reflecting on my scores and assessment, and discussing results with my friends, partner, and colleagues. I want to share some interesting concepts on empathy, which is one of the core components of emotional intelligence. Jamal Zaki, author of War of Kindness, Build Empathy in a Fractured World, talks about this concept called altruism born of suffering, which is used to describe individuals who have suffered pain may become particularly motivated to help others since they have gone through similar experiences. People with these abilities who motivate themselves to come out of a suffering have something called as post-traumatic growth, commonly called as PTG. This is attributed to personal characteristics like promoting resilience, self-confidence, locus of control, and optimism after experiencing a trauma. Now that we've seen how empathy can bring people together and help us develop more self-confidence, let's pivot to understand the downside of having empathy. Paul Bloom, a professor of psychology at Yale and author of Against Empathy, has a very interesting perspective about empathy versus compassion. Bloom uses clinical studies and simple logic to argue that empathy, however well-intentioned, is a poor guide for moral reasoning. Worse to the extent that individuals and societies make ethical judgments on the basis of empathy, they become less sensitive to the suffering of greater and greater numbers of people. A lot of people think empathy and compassion are merely a verbal distinction, that it doesn't matter much. But there is a lot of evidence in this book that empathy and compassion activate different parts of the brain. Empathy means feeling the feelings of other people. So if you're in pain and I feel your pain, I am feeling empathy towards you. If you're being anxious and I pick up your anxiety, if you're sad and I pick up your sadness, I'm being empathetic. And that's different from compassion. Compassion means I give your concern weight, I value it, I care about you, but I don't necessarily pick up your feelings. But more importantly, they have different consequences. If I have empathy towards you, it will be painful if you're suffering. It will be exhausting. It will lead me to avoid you and avoid helping. But if I feel compassion for you, I'll be invigorated, I'll be happy, and I'll try to make your life better. Paul Bloom claims that empathy is biased, pushing us in the direction of parochialism and racism. He says that empathy makes us favoring one over the many. It can spark violence, and our empathy for those close to us is a powerful force for war and atrocity towards others. He writes, "We have a limited capacity for feeling the pain of others, and we tend to identify with those who remind us of ourselves. Empathy is more driven to our tribe, which makes us less caring to people outside of our group. There's an interesting research study I want to share on tribalism. The research group recruited Manchester United fans and asked them to write about why they like Man U, and they asked to go to a campus field to watch the match. And on their way, they saw a jogger who twisted his ankle and fell to the ground. This jogger was an actor, and sometimes he wore a Man U jersey, sometimes a Liverpool jersey, and some other times a plain jersey. Most of the times, the participants stepped over Liverpool jogger, which is an example of classic tribalism. The interesting part of the research is the second version, where they asked Man U fans this time to write about why they love soccer and put them in the same scenario. And after writing why they loved soccer this time, they helped Liverpool fans. But they still did not help the ones who wore the plain jersey, which is somewhat fun. We all have different selves within us. If I think myself as a South Indian, I will be more inclined to my native language speaking people. If I think about myself as an Indian, I will be more inclined towards helping the suffering of Indian people. And if I think myself as a human being, the inclination group will grow even further. If I think myself as just another being on this planet, equal to every other living and non-living thing, then I feel at oneness with everything around me and develop more compassion. People can fundamentally be different for fundamentally similar reasons. We can all have totally different values, and none of them are actually right or wrong. Our opinions depends on the experiences we've had, the things that have hurted us and helped us along the way, and the factors that have influenced us. Oftentimes, when we encounter people who have different opinions than us or a different viewpoint that we abhor, it's easy to view them as obtuse, dishonest, or both. That's a mistake. Psychologists call this as naive realism, which means only your version of the world is real. Empathy at a deeper level means someone else's world is as real as yours.